In the year of surprises, the odds they told a lie. No one predicted Bob Dylan would be the guy. How do words come into fashion? How do prizes seal the deal? Philip Roth after the Nobel, how does it feel?
Welcome to a special edition of Between the Covers, KBOO's program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Blake Bailey, author of the new book, Philip Roth, The Biography, just out from W.W. Norton. Blake is a master of literary biography. In addition to Roth, one of America's greatest novelists, his subjects have included John Cheever, Richard Yates, and Charles Jackson. Blake is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians, and a finalist for the Pulitzer and James Tate Black Prizes. His most recent book, the memoir The Splendid Things We Planned, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in autobiography. As Cynthia Ozick writes on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, the 19th century novel lives on. Its name today is biography. Its nature is that of Dostoevskian magnitude. And Blake Bailey's comprehensive life of Philip Roth, to tell it outright, is a narrative masterwork, both of wholeness and particularity, of crises wedded to character, of character erupting into insight, insight to desire, and desire into destiny. Blake, thanks for joining us today from your home in Virginia.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Blake, this will air a little later, but we're recording the interview on Monday, April 5th, the day before Philip Roth, the biography, is released to the public. You've been working on the book for almost 10 years as Roth's officially authorized biography. The book is much anticipated. And man, yesterday there was interviews and CBS This Morning segment all over the place. More to come this week, I'm sure. I feel a little like a bad sports reporter asking this, but what are you feeling on this publication eve? Excitement, anxiety, relief, exhaustion?
All those things. You know, most of the reviews have been positive. And if you had told me, I don't know, 20 years ago that someday, you know, a 90-something-year-old Cynthia Ozick would compare me to Dostoevsky on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, I would have flagged a cop down and had you carted off to the bin. Of course, I'm thrilled. But you cannot write a Philip Roth biography that pleases everybody. So some people bring some very strange agendas to reviewing this book. It's almost like they knew what they wanted to say and they went looking for whatever supported their thesis. So I'm glad Cynthia's review is coming. The Daily Review by Pearl Siegel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was very vicious and subjective and strange. So that's what I'm dealing with. Since you asked me about the highs and the lows, if you, again, publish a Philip Roth biography, you will get plenty of both.
And we will get into a few of the controversies you know, as part of the discussion. Now, Roth initially chose Ross Miller. He's an author, editor of actually of Ross Library of America books, a multi-volume set, a lit professor, and also the nephew of playwright Arthur Miller, who Roth was friends with. And he chose Ross to write his biography. That was in 2004. But Roth and Miller had a falling out. Is it possible to kind of summarize that conflict of why?
Yeah,
Miller,
I mean, I say quite a bit about it in my book.
Arguably, exactly. Yes.
A little too much. you know, my heart goes out to Ross to some extent, though I think that he also behaved badly. Basically, Ross was Philip's best friend. They met in 1983. Ross gave him a very exhaustive critique of the book he was working on in the mid-80s, which was The Counter Life, and they became chums. So when Claire Bloom's vicious anti-Roth memoir came out in 1996, Leaving a Doll's House, Philip was justifiably alarmed that he could, you know, kick off any day, and that would be his reputation forever. So he wanted to have a corrective biography of himself as soon as possible, preferably written by a sympathetic party, i.e., his best friend, Ross Miller. The conflict of interest there is really too massive to articulate. You know, you're hiring your best friend to do a hit job on a famous actress who's written a mean memoir about you. And this really points to the worst part of Philip's character. You know, he's sort of obsessively self-interested. He tends to be manipulative. And the agreement that Ross and Philip made about that book, I saw, and it's confidential, and I'm not going to discuss the specifics, but it was just a disaster for Ross. That said, Ross was out of his depth. He wasn't interviewing anybody. He wasn't doing the job. And Philip was quite right to become disgruntled and to finally part with him in 2009.
Now, Roth obviously next chose you as his biographer, and that was in 2012. And you've said Philip Roth wants at least one biographer to get it right, more or less. And I'm the lucky guy. And by lucky, I mean very lucky. How did that come about? I read that you were originally referred by another great biographer, James Atlas.
Yeah, I had I was coming. This was March 2012, and I'd come to New York to deliver my photographs to Knopf for the book I just completed, which was the Charles Jackson biography. And Jim was doing this Amazon Short Lives thing. You know, Jim dabbled in publishing, and he wanted me to do a short book for him. So we were just kind of kibitzing, talking shop, and he mentioned that Ross Miller and Philip had parted ways. So that sounded interesting. And I had communicated with Philip before about my Cheever biography because those two had been pleasant acquaintances. And Philip had replied briefly. So I knew his address and I wrote him a letter. And he said, come ahead and we'll talk. And we did.
And you had at least two conversations, one in New York and at his apartment there, and one at his house in Connecticut. It's just, I just love this line because obviously you have very different backgrounds. You're from Oklahoma and not
I am.
Jewish. Philip Roth
No.
from Philip Roth is from Newark and very Jewish. And he asked you about that, and you said, I pointed out that I'm not an aging bisexual alcoholic with an ancient Puritan lineage, and I still managed to write a biography of John Cheever, which seemed to
That's
be in
not
effect.
quite right. That quote
Okay.
is you quoted it the way the New York Times quoted it, and they
That's where I got
misquoted
it,
it.
yes.
We're all aging, not just John Cheever. So I didn't say an aging bisexual. I am aging. I said I'm not a bisexual alcoholic with an ancient Puritan lineage, but I managed to write a biography of John Cheever. And Philip was glad to hear that. You know, it was kind of what he did want to hear, because he didn't want me to perceive my goyishness as a liability, okay? Because Philip said throughout his life, you know, I'm not an American Jewish writer. I am an American writer who happens to be a Jew. And he did not want to be viewed through, I think, a Jewish moral lens. And he didn't want to be ghettoized in any way whatsoever as a Jew. So I think it pleased him that I was going to bring a sort of Gentile objectivity to the proceedings.
Yeah, I think it was in the book. I mean, I've read a lot of secondary sources about your work and Roth, but he said they don't call Updike an American Christian writer. So why should they call
Right.
me an American Jewish writer?
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of see his point, although he did write about Jews quite a bit.
Yes, and we'll talk about that. Now, your previous subjects for your biographies led tragic lives. All three struggled with alcohol. There was also addiction to pills and cigarettes, despite a lot of health problems that those were causing. And in the case of Cheever and Jackson, there was difficulty in coming to terms with their own sexuality. In a 2013 New York Times review of your Jackson biography, which was called Farther and Wilder, Donna Rifkin wrote, Blake Bailey has made a career of chronicling mid-century alcoholic authors whose lives slowly degraded into near total wretchedness. That certainly wasn't the case with Roth. What attracted you to writing about his life?
Well, I'm not exclusively interested in wretchedness. Ruinous, sexually conflicted alcoholics. it was wonderful because, one, it would give me a chance to sort of, reach a little bit, because Philip certainly did not have any problems with alcohol. He was a nice Jewish boy, and that's not part of the picture. He didn't have those kind of problems. And indeed, he said to me, what is this about always writing about people who are constantly drunk or dead? And he said, what about me? And I said, well, you'd be my first non-alcoholic, non-Gentile, etc. But I think I can handle it. What attracts me to any biographical subject is whether I like the work or not. And I started very early reading Philip Roth. I have these old Bannum paperbacks of Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint on my personal little shelf, my tight shelf over here next to my desk, that are held together by 40 years of Scotch tape.
What was the first one? Was it Goodbye Columbus, your first Roth?
I read Portnoy first.
That was same with me, yes.
Okay, yeah. And then I read Goodbye Columbus. And, there are five or six of Philip's books that are among the books I reread periodically, and will continue to do so throughout my life. Namely, Goodbye Columbus, which Philip hated, Portnoy's Complaint, The Ghost Rider, American Pastoral, Every Man, and The Odd Other, The Human Stain, etc. Now, there are 31 books in all, okay? And I had not, when I approached Philip, I had not read every single book. That's a terrible confession for a literary biographer. But I had read most of them, okay? And during one of our early sessions in Connecticut, I had unmistakably tipped my hand that I had never read The Humbling, which was his next to last book, and arguably, or inarguably, his worst. And now, if I were Philip and my biographer had betrayed the fact that he hadn't yet read The Humbling, I would say, great. Stay as far as humanly possible from that. But he wouldn't let it go. He kept nagging me about The Humbling all day. And later we were touring his main house. We did our interviews in his little studio cottage. And he keeps all of his editions in the attic. I mean, thousands and thousands, foreign and domestic. He said, why don't you run up there and get yourself a copy of The Humbling? So, yeah, that's where we left it with that. But no, the reason I approached Philip was I'm not primarily concerned with my subject's lethal alcoholism, etc. I admired his work, and I was very interested in the man.
I should mention that though The Humbling was not that great a novel, his very last book, Nemesis, many people consider that one of his best, and some people considered his best. So he was a guy that wasn't on the decline as a writer, certainly, before he retired.
He was on the decline, and it's very fortunate that he finished with Nemesis and not The Humbling, which would have really besmirched his legacy. But, I mean, it's a testament to Philip's incredible willpower that, I mean, he went through more than 12 drafts of Nemesis. He was desperately trying not to get, blackjacked by Michiko Kakutani again in the New York Times. So he wanted to end on a high note, and he did. But make no mistake about it, Philip was in decline, and he quit at the right time. He didn't have his short-term memory was shot, and he just didn't have the physical energy anymore to do that.
Now, with Cheever, Yeats, and Jackson, your previous subjects for your biographies, of course, they were all dead by the time you started working on those books. But Roth was very much alive. He was 79 at the time in 2012 and very willing to talk with you actually insistent.
Oh boy.
From what you say about talking with you. In a 2013 interview with the Daily Beast, you refer to Roth as an amiable presence in my life. Make of that what you will. Did you see his presence and his conversations with you as both an advantage, but possibly also an obstacle?
It was a bit of both, but mostly an advantage. You know, having said that Philip could be very manipulative and very obsessive, which is like saying that, you know, that wall is blue. I mean, pretty self-evident. You know, he had kind of learned his lesson from his experience with Ross Miller. And I told him rather sternly at the beginning, I said, you know, Philip, I'm fond of you, but I'm not your best friend. And we have to proceed on a professional basis. And part of that was guaranteed by the agreement we signed at the outset, a binding agreement, which is the same agreement I've had with with the estates of my previous subjects. And it's basically, you have to give me complete independence. You have to give me all pertinent documents. You have to make yourself available for interviews. You've got to encourage your friends and family and blah, blah, blah to cooperate with me. And in exchange for that, had he lived, Philip would have been able to vet my manuscript for factual accuracy, not interpretive content. He couldn't say, you know, I am not a misogynist, you know, but factual accuracy. He did die 2 years, let's see, what is it,
2018, I think he died.
Before publication. So the manuscript was vetted by his executors, who are his agent, Andrew Wiley, and a former lover, Julia Golyer, and they were very fair-minded and conscientious about that.
I should mention the epigraph for the book, which you've mentioned in a lot of interviews. His only directive to you, at the start at least, was, I don't want you to rehabilitate me, just make me interesting. But as you mentioned, his obsession, it went beyond that as you went along.
Yeah. You know, Philip wanted to have his cake and eat it too. You know, the public was all too aware of his Mickey Sabbath side, of his tendency, both in his work and in his life, to sexually objectify women and make incredibly tasteless jokes about it. His reputation that followed Claire Bloom's Leaving a Doll's House. And let me just, in this context, briefly address Leaving a Doll's House, which, you know, her account of his shameless adultery is absolutely true. You know, if anything, she didn't know the half of it. Okay.
Yeah,
if you want to know the whole picture, read my book.
I read that you said Philip did not have a monogamous bone in his body.
No, that just was nowhere on the program for Philip. But that said, you know, Claire Bloom also painted him as this Machiavellian, this sinister Machiavellian manipulator bent on persecuting her and her daughter. And that's not true. That's not true. Philip's presence outside of, you know, his sexual wandering in Claire's life was pretty benign, and the problems between her and her daughter existed well before Philip. And indeed, after she had been finished doing publicity for Leaving a Doll's House, Claire Bloom tended to say again and again and again in public interviews that her long, almost 20-year relationship with Philip was the most wonderful relationship in her life, quote, unquote. So make of that what you will.
Now, when you accepted the assignment, you had access to Ross' private papers, including several manuscripts that may never be released to the public and actually might be destroyed. You have to hand them back to Ross' literary executors, I think within 18 months of finishing the book?
A publication.
Yeah. And of course you had access to Roth himself with your conversations. In addition to all his work, and you reread, I think, all of the books and the work about him.
Yes.
That's 31 books, which you've mentioned. And since he's been a very public figure, and that's going back to Goodbye Columbus in 1959, that was absolutely voluminous, to say the least. What was the first steps you took to begin the research? It seemed like climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction to the notes in my book that at one point Philip said, "I've deposited still more papers in my archive at the Library of Congress," and so they weren't cataloged yet. I mean, usually you fill out a card each day and they bring out whatever you've asked for on a little cart. So I said, "I've got to go back there, you know, because these things aren't cataloged. I've got to find them. I've got to see what they are." So he brought me back into the manuscript warehouse. The warehouse is big. You could land a plane in it. And he said, "Okay, this is the Philip Roth stuff." And I said, "What's the Philip Roth stuff?" And we were standing in this enormous row of floor-to-ceiling manuscripts, and he indicated what amounted to the manuscript equivalent of that final crane shot in Citizen Kane.
Yes.
You know, the tragic accumulation of bric-a-brac finally ending on the sled, Rosebud. That's why I'm sensitive. when I get a mean review, you know, you spend 10 years doing something that you didn't think was humanly possible, which is assimilating that, you know, and never mind the 200 interviews, never mind dealing with Philip and all his baggage. And you write what you think is a pretty damn good book, and it's like expecting an A from the professor, you know. And so it was tough. But you asked me about working with Philip, and I want to establish that was usually delightful, you know, especially that first week we spent in Connecticut. He was in a jolly mood. He wasn't writing anymore. It was a great relief. Here was a biographer that he actually wanted and thought would do the job. He was telling me jokes. You know, he could have done that forever. Philip with a new audience was the most delightful person in the world. And that's what that was like. It wasn't always like that, though.
Now, the book itself, which, again, is this almost inhuman accomplishment, it's just a riveting account of Roth's life in chronological order from his grandparents' arrival in America at the turn of the 20th century to Roth's own death in 2018. It's over 800 plus pages. Given your extensive research, which included over 100 interviews, which you list in the book, again, a very careful reading.
More like 200.
More like 200.
Yeah.
I couldn't count them because they were all single lined at the end, I guess, to save pages. And of course, you reread his books, you read the secondary sources. I have to tell you, I was expecting something comprehensive, though maybe a bit dry. But as we mentioned, the Cynthia Ozick comment calling it a narrative masterwork, I was wondering, how do you balance that biographer's obligation to get the facts right with telling those facts, relaying those facts in the form of a entertaining story for the reader?
Well, you know, you start by mentioning how I talk about his ancestors immigrating and blah, blah, blah. And your listeners are like, "Oh, Christ, do I have to plow through all the, you know?" Well, look, I'm done with the ancestors after about three pages. Uh-huh. And then I'm, you know, they're in America and his father is born. And that's quite interesting, in fact. And they're, you know, trying to make it in the Third Ward, the Jewish section of Newark and what that was like. But that first chapter, I'm done with all that. And Philip is born and living in Wequaic within like 15 or 20 pages. You know, I work really hard, really, really hard on the architecture of a book. And I'm constantly thinking of how much does the reader want of this? You know, how lucidly and concisely can I tell it? And what I've been very pleased by, not only in Ozick's review, but in particularly in Ozick's review, is that narratively, I think you're constantly engaged. You're constantly wanting to know what's going to happen next. It's a fascinating life. And some have said this page-turning exuberance is at the expense of critical exegesis. I don't agree. I emphatically don't agree. There were 31 books. I discussed the salient aspects of each and every one of them, and the major work is fairly exhaustively but not tiresomely discussed. I mean, Portnoy, I discuss the manuscripts that he discarded that were sort of evolving into Portnoy, and I talk about the, you know, Analysand conceit and how that sort of made it possible, how it started as a yet another story about his first wife and turned into a story about the mother, and so on. So I think I touch all the bases.
Well, not only as this biographical exegesis, but also I think you have a novelist sensibility, and that New York Times magazine actually said you started wanting to be a writer like Yeats, a novelist, a fiction writer, and then you got into biography. Even though you said it was a small part of the book, I want to read one passage, a very short one from the very beginning about Ross' grandparents, his grandfather, Sender, and his grandmother, Bertha. Sender was hardly one to discourage Bertha's diligence, and at least one of his children, Philip's kindly Uncle Bernie, despised the old man for the way he treated their saintly mother. But then Sender himself was no idler. Over the years, he'd steamed so many hats that one arthritic hand was frozen in a kind of four-finger victory salute, which I think, Blake, is an image that any fiction writer would be proud of.
Thank you.
I mean, it was just amazing. So even though it's just a few pages and you're saying that the reader, oh, I don't want to read this, I don't think that's true once they start reading it. And of course, it offers a lot of context to Philip's Ross' own family, especially his father and his mother, who play a big part in his books and obviously in his life.
Well, no, I mean, the reader can rest assured that whatever has ended up in that relatively short first chapter of 50 has been winnowed and winnowed and winnowed for, you know, only the most fascinating stuff. So, yeah, that's what I work on. I mean, before I write a single sentence of finished prose, all my research is done, and I have spent a year or two organizing the material. Every note is in place. Indeed, I can see sort of the gestalt of every single paragraph. That's how tightly it's organized. And it's organized for narrative speed.
Just out of my own curiosity, Blake, where did you get that image of Sender's arthritic hand? Was that from a secondary source, or did you kind of extrapolate based on his arthritis?
I think Philip did this to me.
Ah,
showed it to me. You know, like live long and prosper.
Mr. Spock, yes.
Exactly. I said, what do you mean? And he did that. And that's what I described. Yeah.
Now, one of the things among many that amazed me about the book are the correspondences you provide between actual events and people in Ross' life and how he used that in his fiction. Here's one example. In the early 60s, Roth was teaching at Princeton. And he traveled all expenses paid to Israel for a symposium, a literary cultural symposium on Jewish issues. He had an audience with then Prime Minister was David Ben-Gurion, who
he had resigned the day before.
Yeah, resigned the day before.
1960.
Right, exactly. And Ben-Gurion made a few remarks on the significance of Israel to Jews. And you point out these were later attributed to a character in one of Ross' novels, The Counterlife, which came out 23 years after this incident.
Not even attributed to Ben-Gurion himself, who has a cameo in that novel.
Okay. Right. Yeah, you mentioned that too.
He gives it to a welder in Haifa, who says, as Ben-Gurion did, when the young, 29 years old, Philip Roth, 30, said, why should we immigrate to Israel, Mr. Prime Minister? And Ben-Gurion, the founder of Israel, walked to the window and he said, you see that bird? That's a Jewish bird. You see that tree? That's a Jewish tree. So, yeah.
He was educating young Roth, I think.
He was educating young Roth. And he did say, as he says to Nathan Zuckerman in The Counterlife, they had a formal picture taken together, and he says, this isn't for you, this is for your parents, so they'll be proud of you. Yeah. And that photo was on his parent Herman and Bessie's side table the rest of their lives, and it did indeed make them proud.
Now, this is not necessarily stuff that Roth pointed out to you. I mean, this must have took some intensive detective work on your part. how did you go about charting all those incredible correspondences between these quotes and these little segments of anecdotes in his life, and how he used them in over 31 different books?
Well, it helps again to have the living man to ask, like, what about this? Did he really say to you, did you take a formal picture with him? I mean, I had the group picture sitting at the conference table in my book with Ben Gurion and Roth and Leslie Fiedler, et cetera. I said, but did, you know, and did he say, and he said, absolutely, that's absolutely true. And my parents were thrilled and they kept that photo the rest of their lives. You know, people are pissed off at me because I've gotten a lot of flack for this, believe it or not. God, you can't win. for subtitling my book, The Biography. Well, I'm sorry, it is The Biography, okay? No other biographer, okay, will have unlimited access to the living man. He is dead, okay? Many of his family and friends and so on have died or are dying off, whom I interviewed, and who wouldn't have talked to me if I hadn't had Roth's approval, if he hadn't encouraged them to cooperate with me. All those personal papers that he gave me will be under seal to the public until 2050. Many of us will die off, and so on, and some of them will likely be destroyed. So I am the only person who had that sort of access. Now, you know, you may or may not like the book that resulted from that, but none will be as definitive because of that absolute access and absolute independence. Does that sound like hubris?
Oh, not at all. I wondered, Blake, were you considering to title the authorized biography
absolutely not, because authorized is a stigmatizing label. I mean, people hear authorized and they think that you're under the guy's thumb.
Whitewashed, yes.
That you're, right, it's a whitewash. You know, you're telling the authorized story. It's authorized in the sense that I had Roth's blessing and I had absolute access to Roth, but I also had absolute independence. And the cooperation agreement that I crafted with him guaranteed that. Now, mind you, sometimes he, in his sly and Philippi way, try to get around that agreement, but I was pretty firm in enforcing it.
Now, there's so much in the book we could talk about, what you wrote about this absolutely incredible career and life. We got a little into the misogyny, which apparently from the early reviews and interviews is a focus of a lot of the questions. But right. I want to talk about the accusations of anti-Semitism, which preceded actually accusations of misogyny, going back to his early stories like The Conversion of the Jews in 1958, which was included in Goodbye Columbus, and never really let up, especially after Portnoy's complaint, where he really, you know, was walloped. But he proceeded apparently undeterred and more determined. He took it almost like a badge of honor and a challenge, would you say?
A challenge, not necessarily a badge of honor. He was very great. Well, everyone thinks that Philip was, you know, because especially all his later photos that were out there for public dissemination are very grim and formidable. Philip was very vulnerable and very, I mean, absolutely sensitive to the point of being flayed. I mean, for example, Claire's book devastated him. He never got over it. That said, you know, he knew that he had an obligation as a free artist in a free country to portray Jews unsympathetically, or the opposite, as he saw fit, usually somewhere in between. Goodbye Columbus, his first book, which made him the youngest winner of the National Book Award at age 26. There is something a little offensive in almost every story. Goodbye Columbus is about a sort of vulgar, Arvist, suburban Jewish family. And Brenda Potemkin gets a diaphragm so they can have, you know, unprotected sex. And so, I mean, that's very scandalous in 1959. In 1959, Leon Uris's Exodus had come out the year before. The Diary of Anne Frank was just being staged on Broadway. Elie Wiesel's English edition of Night was about to be published. And, you know, consciousness of the Holocaust was understandably rife in this country. And it was shaming. It was shaming this idea that the Jews had been perceived as lower than animals and slaughtered like animals, and that a Jewish person would do anything but try to sort of elevate the Jews above the possibility of being stigmatized like that again was baffling to, you know, rabbis and so forth. And he was roundly denounced the world over by the Jewish cultural establishment.
Now, he wrote an essay, which you talk about in the book, called Imagining Jews, and that was for a 1974 issue of the New York Review of Books. I just want to thank David Beilspiel. He's an Oregon poet, for mentioning this in the Houston Chronicle when he reviewed your book, yesterday's edition. And since we just observed Passover, which is a celebration of the Jewish people's exodus from Egypt, I was struck by the line from Ross' essay, talking of himself, and he compares himself with his contemporaries, Saul Bellow and Bernard Malamud. He writes, it's no wonder that their novels, whatever may be their differences in literary merit and approach, are largely nightmares of bondage, each informed in its way by a mood of baffled, claustrophobic struggle. And he ends the essay, for as the most serious of American Jewish novelists seem to indicate in those choices of subject and emphasis that lead to the heart of what a writer thinks, there are ways of living, many having to do with the least tame of our passion, that not even spirits as unfettered as theirs are able to attribute to the character who is forthrightly presented as a Jew. Do you see that as a major theme in Ross' work? You seem to have implied that already, a kind of taking what the image of the Jew was at that time in the late 50s and considering that kind of almost a form of bondage. And Roth wanted to free the imaginary Jew, the Jew as imagined by Jewish writers in fiction, from that bondage.
Right, exactly. You know, there's a very telling line in the first novel of the Zuckerman sequence, The Ghostwriter, which is, I think, Philip's greatest book, where Nathan Zuckerman reads that Isaac Babel had said the Jewish writer is a person with spectacles on his nose and autumn in his heart. And Zuckerman adds, and blood in his penis.
Yes, I love okay. That line. Yes.
And kind of the point of Imagining Jews, it's a typical Roth performance. It's a fascinating essay, but of course it's written to exonerate himself, which was kind of at the bottom of all his nonfiction. What had happened was, it was published in 1974, 2 years before Irving Howe had exhaustively attacked, denounced, condemned Roth for Portnoy's complaint in Commentary, that there had been a wave of philo-Semitism in this country after World War II, said Irving Howe, as a result of a certain unpleasantness that had occurred during World War II.
Yes.
And that now is safely at an end because of Portnoy's complaint. And, you know, you really can't wrap your head around how violent the reaction was to Portnoy's complaint about this boy who's kind of afflicted by a typical Jewish mother, you know, afflicted with terrible feelings of guilt against which he rebels by this compulsive masturbation, even with his family's liver. Okay. It remains to this day one of the filthiest books ever written, and one of the funniest. So anyway, you know, here he is. Marie Serkin, who is this famous Zionist, said that, you know, Roth was an anti-Jewish propagandist on a par with Goebbels and Stryker. Okay, and Gershom Scholem said this is effectively going to precipitate a second Holocaust. These things were said. These things were believed. And so in Imagining Jews, Philip said that, you know, in Bello and Malamud's work, when they write about schematically virtuous characters, those characters, you know, who are very abstemious in their everyday conduct, are always Jews. You know, it's almost a stereotype, and sort of the lustful, you know, intemperate sort are always Gentiles. And that's especially present in Malamud's book. This caused a terrible rift between him and Malamud. And he said, I wrote about a guy, you know, who chases Shiksa and jerks off a lot. And because it's time we moved on. You
right.
know? Yeah.
And we should make clear that Roth himself saw himself as an ethnic Jew, a non-secular Jew, not a religious one. Yeah, yesterday you were on, I think I mentioned the segment of CBS Sunday Morning, where you went to his hometown.
It was CBS This Morning Saturday, just to be clear. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I look back a little over 10 years, Roth was on a similar show on CBS.
It was CBS Sunday Morning.
I okay, think. That was CBS Sunday Morning.
And this is CBS This Morning Saturday.
Oh, okay. But so I just wanted to mention what he said on that show, where Roth himself was on. So that was about 2011, I think, something like that. And the interviewer asked Roth, do you consider yourself a religious person? He said, no, I don't have a religious bone in my body. Interviewer, you don't? Roth, no. So do you feel like there's a God out there? Roth said, I'm afraid there isn't. No. Interviewer, you know that telling the whole world that you don't believe in God is going to have people say, oh my goodness, that's a terrible thing for him to say. And Roth said, when the whole world doesn't believe in God, it will be a great place. So it seemed like, I mean, he was courting controversy there, not quite as bad as John Lennon saying the Beatles were bigger than Jesus, but you can't say something like that on network television and not expect some blowback.
Yeah, you know, by that point in his career, it was 2010, Nemesis was about to come out. Philip had kind of gotten used to, you know, getting it coming and going. I mean, regardless of what he said, if he tried to be accommodating and non-controversial, he still got it in the keister, right? So
there was no point.
He just wasn't going to play that game anymore. And plus, Philip had scathing contempt for what he always called the moronic inferno. And that's hard to define in so many words, but it's just basically sort of the Philistine kitsch culture that is all too pervasive in America. And sweet Rita Braver, you know, is asking these fluffy questions about, you know, whether he believes in God or not. And Philip was staunchly anti-God and anti-religion. And that was a slow curve that he was going to knock out of the ballpark. And that's what he did.
And that, you know, that's great. Your memory is just fantastic. That was Rita Braver, right? Was the interviewer.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in spite of those accusations of anti-Semitism and later misogyny, and his falling out with several of his colleagues, two ex-wives, his lovers, and as we made clear, it's almost an obsessive dedication to his art. You talk about it's almost like a monkish existence. He got up every day at the same time, wrote, just had this incredible schedule and got his pages in every day. You also write about his many acts of kindness and generosity and his friends and your relationship with him. And you said, it's impossible not to feel tenderly toward Philip if you knew him well. What engendered those tender feelings in you? His sense of humor, his kindness, his willingness to answer your questions,
What made one feel tenderly toward Philip? The vast disparity between the public image and the private human being. Again, during that very first meeting that I had with Philip in his Upper West Side apartment, he was grilling me rather grimly. He had just had spinal fusion surgery, so he was in pain, and he was in a bad mood. And the subject of Claire Bloom came up. And his face, I mean, he looked like he was, this is a terrible way to put it, but it's the best I can do offhand. He looked like he was a little boy who'd suddenly been slapped. Anyone who thinks that Philip didn't take life hard and wasn't sensitive hasn't read his work and never spent 30 seconds in his presence. Also, what was incredibly endearing about Philip was that even when he was in pain, in poor health, and in a bad mood, he was still funny, and you could always appeal to the humor that was just a little bit under the surface, always. One of our last meetings, he just was in terrible shape. He just had an aortic valve replacement, and he could barely get out of his seat and go to the bathroom. That's how exhausted he was. And I had spent earlier that day going through files at his agent, Andrew Wiley's office, and I had found something that was rather damning and that I wanted to get to the bottom of. So I was asking him these questions, and he was saying, I don't want to talk about that. It's not my interest. You know, you need to change the subject. And he was getting more and more agitated. And finally he sort of shook his head, you know, like a terrier, and said, this is the best I've felt in weeks, you, and called me an obscenity that I can't repeat on your family show.
Now, we kind of touched on this a little earlier, Blake, but one of the most surprising events, I think, for a lot of people, not just me, in Ross' life was his retirement from writing fiction. You said it was probably a good idea. He was certainly on the decline. His short-term memory was shot. But usually artists in any medium, music, painting, literature, they keep making art until they're physically unable to, or they pass away. But he stopped after finishing that final novel, Nemesis. And in October 2010, he wrote, "For the first time in my adult life, I haven't written a word of fiction for over a year. The tyranny of writing and the tyranny of sex," which I mean, imagine his
which was an almost equal tyranny.
His libido, overthrown. Now, you could say that writing and sex were his major obsessions, but now that they were gone, he still seemed truly happy in the last year of his life. I should mention also, I think his back pain had gone away, at least for a while. He wasn't feeling it like he was throughout his entire life. What was your impression in your final conversations? Did he seem like a truly happy man there from his retirement till his death in 2018?
Philip was terrified throughout his writing career. I mean, he almost always thought that the novel he just finished would be his last. It was just so hard, such hard work. And he just, every time, he just couldn't believe he'd pulled it off again.
Isn't that incredible?
His friend Julius Goldstein said, yeah, you put another one over on the public, Lefty. So he always thought he was going to, you know, be left with any time, like Irving Berlin said, I'm going to reach for it and it won't be there. And I'm going to have to stop. And what'll I do? What'll I do? I'm empty when I don't have the problems of a novel to solve. So Philip stopped, and he found that it wasn't so bad. You know, suddenly he had time to get back in touch with all these darling people from his past whom he'd, you know, neglected all but entirely because of his writing. Got back in touch with his beloved girlfriend of the 60s, Ann Mudge. She was an old lady. Lucy, another person from the 60s, they became dear, dear friends again. All that was very nice. He liked sitting around reading the paper, you know, in the woods, in his house, outside his house in Connecticut, and so on. Also, he liked working on his biography. He liked going through his files, reliving the past. You know, as he told the BBC, I have miles of files. So, you know, that was 2 or 3 years of work right there, sending me fat envelopes with little memos attached telling me what I was supposed to think about them. Toward the very end, I think he was becoming less content. He didn't feel great, and he was lonely. You know, I mean, what you have to bear in mind about Philip was that his immediate family was gone. His older brother died in 2009, and he had no family, he had no children. He was estranged from his previous wives. And that's hard when you get old and infirm. You know, he would have liked to have, he avoided children all his life because he didn't have time for it, as he saw it. But he would have liked to have a doting child there at the end to take him to the hospital and back.
Now, I know you must miss him as most of us miss him, and certainly his work or new work, even though he retired 8 years before his death. His birthday was just about 2 weeks ago, March 19th. Do you do anything special to commemorate that day?
I'm trying to remember what we I always send a loving tweet on Philip's birthday, and I always, you know, pause and reflect. You know, it was just it's sort of the great experience of my life working on this book and knowing Philip. I think he was a great man. He was a great man. He was one of our greatest American writers. I was about to say post-war. He was one of the greatest American writers, period. No less than the BBC said that the greatest writer since Tolstoy, who never won the Nobel. and again, you know, you keep asking, what do I mean when I say he was so endearing? You kind of had to be there. But Philip was the kind of person, he would tell you anything. Even though, you know, I mean, having said how invested he was in sort of pushing his own interests, Philip just, he had no, what's the word? That's what I was looking for. He had no filter. And sometimes he'd be telling me these stories and I would be thinking, why is he telling me this? I'm his biographer. I'm going to write it down. He didn't care, you know, I mean... Part of that was the loneliness that any writer like Philip feels, and they, you know, they crave human company, and they spend their life depriving themselves of it. But he was just, he had a sweetness to him that if you knew him well, you experienced.
Well, Blake, I want to close with another quote from that Cynthia Ozick New York Times book review. She writes, "The biographer's unintrusive everyday prose is unseen and unheard. Yet under Bailey's strong light, what remains on the page is one writer's life as it was lived and almost as it was felt." And I have to say, after reading the book, I have to agree with her. It's an absolutely remarkable achievement. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Will we go on turning pages? Philip Roth believes we won't.
We've been talking with Blake Bailey, author of the new book, Philip Roth, The Biography, out now from W.W. Norton. You can find out more about Blake, the new book, and his upcoming events at blakebaileyonline.com. Just a reminder that we're in the middle of our KBOO Spring Membership Drive. If you enjoyed our conversation with Blake, you can show your support for this program and all your favorite KBOO programs by donating to our Spring Drive today at kboo.fm/give. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been a special edition of Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Blake for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.
Mm-hmm. And goodbye. We will miss you in the fall, in the winter, in the spring. But someday we shall return. Till then, goodbye, Ohio State. Goodbye, red and white. Goodbye, Columbus. Goodbye, Columbus.